The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Harold McGee is a well-known authority on the science of cooking and the author of one of the most important books on food chemistry, On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, which was first published in 1984 and updated 20 years later. He's written on food for the New York Times, Nature, Food and Wine, and many other publications, and lectures frequently on food chemistry around the country. Knowing the importance and influence of smell on how we taste food, McGee's latest book is a compendium of the smells in our world and in our food. What began as a look at the volatile compounds we smell in food in its raw and cooked form, it soon became an exhaustive examination of all the smells we perceive in the world. His new book, Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells, is a 600-page book documenting the chemical compounds we smell every day. Everything from animal smells, human smells, plant smells, trees, soils, fungi, water life, industry, and yes, foods as well. It's a rather remarkable journey that McGee has taken, trying as much as possible to experience these smells firsthand. He joins us to talk about his book, Nosedive, today on Studio Tulsa. Harold McGee, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Rich.
You know, I always remember from being a kid and when I had something I didn't particularly want to eat, you know, my parents would say, hold my nose, and I could get it down. And, you know, of course, we know that more than half of the flavor of food comes from the smell. So it seems natural that a food writer such as yourself, who specializes in the chemistry of food, would wind up exploring smells. But what led you to dive into this in the comprehensive way you did in Nosedive?
Well, it did start out as a book just about flavor, about the smells and tastes of food and drink. But the more I learned about the smells, which are the give us most of the variety of food flavors, the more curious I became about the other smells that I was encountering in everyday life. And that just got me more and more intrigued, and I ended up expanding the focus of the book beyond food and drink to everything else that I could think of that has a smell.
Now, in the book, you tell us about your experience eating your first grouse. Was that a motivating force, or was that just a device in the book?
No, that was truly a remarkable moment in my life. I'd been writing at that point about food and drink for a couple of decades, so I kind of knew my way around. And I read about grouse, which is a seasonal game bird in the UK, but I'd never had a chance to taste it. And so I happened to be in London during the season, and I ordered it for lunch. Wasn't expecting it to be that different from, you know, duck or pigeon or, you know, some of the more flavorful birds that we can get in this country. But the flavor of that grouse was so intense and so a little bit disturbing, you know, as if there were something off about it, that I paused in my conversation with my table mates. I couldn't speak for 30 seconds or so. And that got my attention. That made me think, okay, this is a powerful, potentially powerful sense, and I need to know more about it.
And what is it about grouse that makes it so different?
Well, it is a truly wild bird. And, you know, we don't get the chance to eat wild game, truly wild game in this country. It's all farm-raised for health and safety reasons. But in the UK, you can, and grouse is shot on the wing, and it's a small bird, and it's a powerful flyer, so its muscles are really dark red, like they look like beef. And they're full of biochemical machinery to help them fly that fast, and that machinery has a very intense flavor. And then the way they handle the grouse is that after it's shot, they let it mature for a few days, as they call it, with the innards intact. And the innards begin to disintegrate a little bit over that time, and so they end up flavoring the bird as well. So it's that combination of really intense meatiness and then a slight funk that makes it a really remarkable experience.
And what's interesting in your book is you tackle all the smells associated with that grouse and much, much more, but including the putrefaction smells that are a part of that experience within this book. This is an exhaustive book of smells, and you've actually referred to it, never heard this word before, osmocosm. What is the osmocosm? And I may be saying that wrong.
No, I actually made that word up because I kept reaching for a term that could mean something like the total universe of smells, the world of smells as a kind of composite. And I kept saying world of smells, world of smells. I finally thought, you know, I need to come up with a word that can mean that. And so osme is a Greek, comes from a Greek root meaning smell. And cosm, you know, the cosmos. So it's the cosmos of volatile molecules.
The book becomes a complete compendium. You go through everything from the smells of putrefaction, this animal smells, human smells, plant smells, natural element smells. What's really interesting is people have different reactions to smells. And so how do you quantify the smell when people will perceive it very differently?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that decided me very early on in the writing of this book that I was going to set aside the subjective perception of smells, which, as you say, just varies tremendously from one person to another, and focus on the molecules that are out there that we are capable of smelling, whether or not we happen to do so, and no matter what our reaction to it might be. Some of us might like it, some of us might be disgusted. So I kind of set that aside and just focus on what's out there and what it's doing out there.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. How big is our emotional state and how we've been exposed to a smell? How does it affect how we react to it? I know in my own life, I grew up in my very earliest life very close to an oil refinery. Now, when most people smell the volatiles associated with an oil refinery, the refined petroleum products, it is a sickening sweet smell. I think that might be a way to describe it. And most people say, ooh, that stinks. Well, it doesn't stink to me. It almost makes me think of my earliest home life. I mean, I have these emotional connections. Can you maybe talk about how that difference will affect how you perceive a smell?
Yeah, I had a similar kind of experience growing up and walking home from school with my friends when I was in grade school, because my mother was born and raised in India. And so we would, you know, a couple times a week have Indian food. And I grew up in a suburb of Chicago in the 1950s when, you know, the smells of Indian food were unusual, to say the least. And I would be walking home, and half a block away, I could smell dinner, and my stomach started rumbling because I had been brought up on that kind of food, and I loved it, and it was satisfying. My friends would be saying, oh, what's that? because it was so strange, and because they didn't associate it with the pleasure of sitting down at the table and satisfying hunger. So yeah, the reaction that we have to smells when we detect them depends really, really deeply on our past experience of those smells and our associations of everything else in life with those smells.
So how did you divorce that subjective feeling in describing the smells of all these substances that you put to? I mean, basically you're looking more at the chemical compounds as opposed to the actual items themselves.
That's right. So an important thing that I learned early on in the writing of the book is that we think of smells as unitary, unified kinds of things, like, you know, the smell of parsley is parsley. But in fact, all the smells in the world that we experience are composites. They're more like chords in music. They're made up of individual notes, which come from individual molecules, and those notes combine to give us the overall impression. And so what I tried to do in the book is, not to describe kind of in emotional terms what smells are like, but to describe them by way of the component notes that go into making the overall smell.
Now, what factor does geography and terroir, if you will, you know, that is a term that is used in wine, that's the quality of the earth and the place where the grapes are grown affecting the final product, which is wine. How much is that a part of all sorts of plant material and animal material that we might consume? You know, the beef we eat, is it informed by the grass the cow's eating, or the corn the cow's eating, or, you know, strawberries grown in France, are they going to taste different than strawberries grown in California?
Yeah.
Are they going to smell different?
Question.
Smell different.
Yeah. So all these examples that you gave, they're edibles, they're food and drink, and it's absolutely true that the molecules that give us the impression of the flavors of those foods depends very much on the circumstances in which those foods are produced. So just to take the example of grass-fed and grain-fed beef, the source of their food has a direct and tremendous effect on the composition, chemical composition of their muscles, and in particular of their fats, the fats in the muscle. And so depending on what their diet has been, especially in the last months of their lives, you get very different aromas. And that's a great example of how, you know, Americans are used to grain-fed beef, that particular kind of nutty, rich flavor, and we enjoy that a great deal, whereas in other parts of the world where grain feeding has not been as predominant and most cattle are raised in pasture, that particular flavor is seen as, you know, something odd and something unusual and not what they're looking for. They're looking for something more, it's almost a kind of metallic quality to the beef that comes from grass feeding. So it very much depends, the flavor depends on how the animals are raised, and then our perception of those flavors depends on what we're expecting.
And when it comes to the smells, a lot of times when if you're cooking a steak, for example, you're smelling the fats.
That's right. Cooking is a part of food preparation that, you know, we don't think so much about flavor during the cooking process because it's not actually in our mouths. But in fact, good cooks are paying attention all the time to the smells that are wafting up from the frying pan or from the grill, and they're noticing whether the cooking is going the way it should and, you know, when the cooking is done. All kinds of decisions are made on the basis of smell before the food even gets onto the plate.
My guest today is Harold McGee, a food writer who specializes in the chemistry of food, and his latest book is Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. And he is our guest today on Studio Tulsa, and this is a comprehensive book. It smells everything from the smells of rocks, soils, grasses, trees, plant material, animal byproducts. There's a big section that will appeal to the teenage boy in all of us on human smell byproducts, if I can put it that way. Let's just talk about some of the things that I've learned from this book, and that is hydrogen sulfide. We associate it with the rotten egg smell, and if you've ever been to Yellowstone or any other hot springs that have sulfuric bases, you'll know this smell very well. Or sort of an overdone hard-boiled egg, you'll know this smell. We refer to it as the rotten egg smell, but is it?
So hydrogen sulfide is a fascinating molecule. It's very small, just three atoms, and in fact it exists in outer space. It forms all by those atoms' selves. They will find each other and they will form this eggy molecule in outer space.
So you're saying that outer space smells like flatulence?
Among other things, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so hydrogen sulfide is, because it's such a small molecule, it's very simple. It's produced in all kinds of conditions on the Earth, including hot springs, so geothermal areas, volcanoes. It's a kind of mineral smell in that sense. But it's also given off by eggs as they're cooking, because eggs are very rich in sulfur-containing amino acids. And so one byproduct of heating those amino acids is the generation of hydrogen sulfide. When it's really prominent, as it is in an overdone hard-boiled egg, then it's maybe, you know, a little much. But in traces, if you let that hard-boiled egg sit for a day, much of the hydrogen sulfide will dissipate. A little bit will be left, so the egg will still taste eggy, but it won't be as overwhelming. And then that same molecule and relatives of it are very important trace compounds in many foods and drinks, including things like fruits and meats. It's just important throughout our experience.
Now, I want to ask you about another one that you actually quantify animal smells. And one that I have noticed, my daughter has a dog that will smell occasionally like, I call it Fritos smell or corn chip smell. That actually is a substance associated with dogs. It's amino acetophenone, I guess, and I may be messing up that name. But what is important about this substance, which I always assumed with stress on the dog?
Yeah, so this corn chip smell in dogs has been remarked on now for a long time, and it turns out that molecule, amino acetophenone, you said it perfectly, is produced by microbes. And so it's a sign that it's time for a bath, essentially, because all of us animals, dogs and human beings included, are hosts to billions and billions of microbes all the time. And many of them, most of them, are harmless and actually do us good by being in us and on us. But sometimes microbes that are either not helpful or downright dangerous can end up on us. And it turns out that amino acetophenone is produced by microbes that mostly are not a problem. But if, for example, an animal gets a scratch or a wound on its foot, this particular microbe can cause problems. So it's a kind of fun association to think that your dog smells like a snack, but it is a sign that it's probably time for that pet to have a bath.
Now, along with that dog smell, you remark upon that cat urine has been studied far more than you ever thought. And this is how deep into this you go. You actually look at animal byproducts, human byproducts, and you have a little bit on cat urine. Why is it studied so much?
Well, it's studied for a couple of reasons. One of them is that it's actually a remarkable system that the cat has come up with for a kind of controlled release smell. So cats, of course, and many animals signal to each other with smells, either to attract each other
or repel
each other. Yeah. In the case of the male tomcat, it will often mark its territory by using its urine. The thing about smells, though, is that they are kind of evanescent. You know, they evaporate away, and after a while, they're not there anymore. So what the cat has come up with is a system of producing a molecule in its urine that by itself has no smell, but then when it's on the pavement, microbes will begin to grow in the urine, which is a very nutritious medium for microbes. And the microbes will break that non-smelly molecule down into something that it can that the microbe can use, but then also this smelly byproduct. And this is a process that is gradual, so that smell is wafting from the pavement for many, many days after the cat was there. And it turns out that flavor scientists and fragrance scientists are interested in that particular molecule because it ends up appearing in places that you would never expect, which is to say foods and drinks. Roasted meats and some tropical fruits have traces of this molecule that the cat is using to signal to its fellow cats to stay away or that this is my territory. That same molecule is there in traces to give interest to foods that we enjoy.
Interesting. I would think maybe air fresheners or something you wanted to last longer in the environment or something like that. My guest today is Harold McGee, a food writer and food chemist. His latest book is Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. This is a 600-page book. If you are a fan of chemistry, there's plenty of chemistry, but also just great text on the compendium of smells. And it, you really go from the earth's foundational elements to animal smells, human smells, plant smells, and everything in between, soils, fungi, stone, industry, as well as foods. One of the things that you have a section on conifers, and I think anybody who goes into a mountainous region where conifers trees predominate notices that smell of freshness that conifers give off, and that's actually the resin. What purpose does that heavily fragrant trees, what is it doing besides smelling nice when you go visit the mountains?
Well, that's absolutely right. It smells wonderful, and we have this association of those smells with freshness because that's where we encounter those smells. But it turns out that in the life of the tree, those molecules are there as part of a package of biological weapons. So the trees are growing in nature, and nature is full of all kinds of creatures that thrive and survive by consuming other creatures, animals, of course, but also microbes of all kinds. And so living things have to protect themselves from other living things. And in the case of the conifers, what they do is they generate a particular group of compounds called the terpenoids. The same term gives us the word turpentine. It produces these terpenoids in order to repel insects and molds, fungi, plant diseases, so that they can thrive in the environments that they live in.
And just as we are attracted to that smell, we associate with freshness and nature, a lot of plant smell materials, which are produced to ward off invaders or animals that would eat it, actually attract us. And I'm thinking of herbs.
Yes, and that's one of the wonderful things about being human beings. We can actually enjoy these chemical weapons rather than being put off by them or injured by them. And the reason for that is that, you know, if you imagine yourself being an insect taking a bite out of a mint leaf or an oregano leaf, that's going to be one powerful experience. And we can kind of get an idea of that by, you know, stuffing our mouths full of one of those herbs. It would be pretty unpleasant. But instead of doing that, what we're doing, of course, is eating foods that are mostly relatively bland, like meats and grains, wheat, rice, and that kind of thing. They don't have a whole lot of flavor themselves. So we use these plant chemical weapons as seasonings. We use them in small amounts to stimulate our sense of smell, and we don't take enough of them in to be injured by them, so we can enjoy what to the plant itself is produced for defensive purposes.
Now, you get to about page 484 to begin the section on cooked foods, which, you know, going into this is what I thought this book was going to all be about. But you spend so much time preparing us for this section, which is the idea of cooked foods and the smells associated with them. You say there are four main bouquets of cooked volatiles. What are those, and how do we experience them?
Well, so, of course, we cook lots and lots of different foods. You know, if we're using herbs and spices and that kind of thing, then the flavors end up being dominated by those particular accents. But no matter what it is that we're cooking, organic materials, plants, plant tissues and animal tissues, tend to give off a set of molecules that give us a general kind of impression. And so I organized those impressions into four groups. There's a kind of general fatty aroma, or, you know, rich kind of aroma. There's a sulfurous aroma, which comes from those from hydrogen sulfide and from its relatives. There's a nutty aroma and a roasted aroma. And these are all kind of sequential. So at lower temperatures, you get the fatty and the sulfurous. At higher temperatures, you get those toasted, roasted notes.
Mm. Well, one of the things I was struck by as you're giving this all these smells, how many of these smells did you feel like you had to experience yourself? I mean, some you probably do in the course of your normal work and day, but obviously some of them you had to search out. Did you actually try to smell them?
I did indeed, yes. And so that included, for example, a trip to Singapore to experience durian, which is this notorious tropical fruit that smells at its best. Smells like garlic and onions mixed with strawberries. So, yeah, whenever I could, I experienced that material myself. Wasn't always possible. For example, there are some fermented fish products that are made in Iceland that I did not get the chance to try, but I included them because they've been analyzed by food scientists, and so we at least know what the components are.
How has this changed the way you experience food today, having done all of this research, and how you taste and smell the sort of thing that you're involved in, food writing?
Well, it affected me the way I hope that this book will affect its readers. It just generally made me pay more attention. You know, I really didn't realize what a wonderfully rich aspect of experience this was. Of course, I enjoyed flavors of food and drink, but I hadn't realized how just walking through the world, you're exposed to and have the chance to experience so many different aspects of that world. And so I just pay more attention now than I used to.
Well, it is a comprehensive guide. The name of the book is Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. Harold McGee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It was a pleasure.
Food chemistry and food writer Harold McGee speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.